This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Buzzkillers, buzzkillers, it is the professor here. And fortunately for you, fortunately for everyone listening to the show, we have three real professors on the line to talk to us today about the Munich Conference, and especially about new research that's happened about the Munich Conference and new interpretations and new material that's been discovered. And of course, we have two wonderful veterans of the show, Dr. Julie Gottlieb, who's been on the show before, talking to us about appeasement. How are you, Professor?
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for having me on the show today.
And Dr. Richard Toy from the University of Exeter, who's talked to us about Churchill a number of times. Thank you for coming, Professor.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we have a brand new guest on the show, a brand new historian who's not a brand new historian, but he's certainly new to the show. And that's Dr. Daniel Hucker of the University of Nottingham. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Many thanks for having us. It's a great pleasure to be here.
This is such an important new book, and it's a subject that is very, very well covered, not only in popular history and academic history, but also, you know, it's one of these things that used to show up on the History Channel all the time. It shows up on documentaries endlessly, the Munich crisis, the Munich conference, appeasement, Hitler, Chamberlain, and all that sort of stuff. One would think that there's no more room for any more work, but I think what this book has shown is there's immense room for more work. But before we get into that, will Professor Hucker, will you explain to us, to make sure we all know where we're starting from, what the Munich crisis and the Munich conference was, what all that stuff was about?
I shall certainly try. Where to start? I'll try and keep it brief. Essentially, the Munich conference was, in many ways, the ultimate act of appeasement, the well-known British policy of appeasement in the 1930s. But in reality, it traces its roots all the way back to the 1919 peace settlement after the First World War. And the successor states that were created in that agreement, notably Czechoslovakia, which incorporated within its new boundaries areas comprised chiefly of ethnic Germans. And this later, come 1938, becomes quite a fraught diplomatic issue. After Hitler has accomplished the Anschluss with Austria in early 1938, he turns his attention towards the ethnic Germans within the Sudetenland areas of Czechoslovakia and seeks to incorporate them back into the greater German Reich. And over the summer of 1938, this kind of crisis escalates and culminates in September with various different meetings between Prime Minister of Britain, Neville Chamberlain, and Hitler, culminating ultimately in the Munich Conference at the very end of September, in which the British, the Germans, the Italians, and the French get together to essentially resolve this crisis. And they do so by effectively surrendering Czechoslovakian territory, the Sudetenland, back to Germany. And notably, of course, Czechoslovakia weren't actually involved in those negotiations.
Yes, it reminds me somewhat of this, some of the aspects of the Paris Peace Conference, the Treaty of Versailles, the number of people who aren't consulted. And I mean, in the popular mind, I think people say, well, we should have stopped Hitler at Munich. That's a very, very common phrase. Why wasn't that done?
It wasn't done because many people actually believed that what Hitler was actually seeking was perhaps not unreasonable, that simply incorporating ethnic Germans back into Germany, where they wanted to be, was simply Wilsonian self-determination.
Yeah, okay.
So, you could easily justify this on those kind of legalistic and moral grounds. But I think more specifically, people didn't want to prevent this from happening because it seemed that the only way of preventing it would be going to war. And people, simply put, did not want to go to war. We were within literally just a couple of decades of the previous war, which had been so destructive. And people were particularly acutely conscious that the next war, a future war, would be even more devastating and catastrophic than the last one. So it's a fusion of different factors, I think, really underpins why Hitler was not stopped in 1938. And that's before we even get into unpicking the particular personal motivations of Neville Chamberlain
right.
in particular.
Right. Professor Gottlieb, as I said at the very beginning, this is one of the most studied aspects of the lead up to World War II. Why do we need a new book? And specifically, why do we need a new book that has so many chapters by different scholars on highly specific aspects of Munich? What was the intellectual drive behind saying, let's have a new recontextualization of Munich?
Thank you. That's a really important question. And it's good to have the opportunity to talk about the journey that we took together as a group of scholars, all of whom came from different perspectives in terms of method, in terms of kind of concept and the way that we write history, but also different national examples. And why the urgency, why the timeliness of this project? Well, part of it was that we were reaching the 80th anniversary of Munich, and anniversaries obviously come together with renewed interest and moments of reflection. And we wanted to make sure that that moment of reflection, as you know, certainly in Britain and elsewhere, we get very obsessed with anniversaries. We wanted to make sure, as scholars who knew this subject inside out from our different angles, that this received, you know, a proper consideration, and that the public discourse would be, you know, not so distorted as it often is, or so kind of tunnel vision, because the stress is always on the high politics, on the diplomatic history. And what we wanted to do was bring to bear new methods, new ways of thinking about history, and also thinking about the crisis. And this was what united us all in one way or another, thinking about the crisis not only as something remotely diplomatic and high political, but something that affected people everywhere, that it was, in fact, a people's crisis.
And Professor Toy, if I could ask, what ways did the various historians go about looking into these other aspects of Munich? Because as we've all talked about in setting up this show, it's one of these things that might have been, Munich is often seen as overwritten, and it's certainly overwritten from a high political standpoint. But you, all of you and all the contributors to the book have shown what has been left unresearched. What was done by the other authors?
Well, I think that probably one thing which many of the chapters have got in common is the use of either survey material, so public opinion evidence, such as from the sociological research organization Mass Observation in the case of Britain, or from authorities in Germany, for example, the Sicherheitsdienst, the SD, which monitored the views of the population, because the Nazis were trying to control the population and therefore wanted to know what they were thinking, and therefore were writing up their views in considerable detail, what they could learn of them. And equally in the case of Italy, for example, a chapter in the book draws on letters which were written to Mussolini. And these sort of can cast light on what people wanted. It wasn't only the British people who didn't want war, in fact. The German people didn't want war. The Italian people didn't want war. Mm-hmm. And the German and Italian authorities weren't necessarily best pleased about that. They didn't want people writing to them saying, you know, thank you for sort of having averted this war, because they wanted their people to be warlike. They wanted them to sort of, you know, relish this conflict. So this evidence can reveal, you know, sort of the disjuncture, if you like, between popular and elite views.
I think most of our listeners will be astounded to know, we've hinted at this in some earlier shows, they'll be astounded to know the depth and for the time, the sophistication of public opinion polling. You know, we normally think, well, you know, they just didn't do that at the time, or Gallup polls were so old or so embryonic and unreliable. But it's in fact, it is a very, very big deal.
But on this question of public opinion, it's a really vital one here. And it's very new in Britain, the systematic polling and surveying. So 1937, so just a year before the Munich crisis, it's when we have the launch of British Gallup, or BPO, the British Institute for Public Opinion. And at the same time, using different techniques, but also very innovative, there was controversy about its techniques and concern that they weren't particularly scientific. But at the same time, we have the birth of mass observation, which we've already mentioned. So I think they're important both in what they will reveal to us about public opinion around Munich. And mass observation ran a study precisely on the crisis of the mm-hmm. Munich crisis. And again, the public response, the personal response, the internalization of crisis across the class spectrum, but mainly in the working classes. And again, a really unique perspective that we wouldn't have had any other way unless we'd had that study. In both cases, as I say, what's interesting is the fact that these organizations are being born in this time. So the advent of these organizations to monitor and to survey and to collect this data is as interesting as the data that is being collected. Mm-hmm. And that is really, again, the outcome of the attempt to democratize foreign policy and international relations in the whole period, starting in the end of the First World War. And both are really the result of that drive to try to, empower public opinion when it came to matters of peace and, more importantly, matters of war.
So there are a number of things going on. And as you say, the mobilization of public opinion is crucial. Professor Hucker?
Yeah, just to pick up on Julie's comments, obviously opinion polling was itself very new. As Julie said, the British arm of Gallup only starts in 1937, the French arm a year later in 1938. But what's striking, I think, about both those organisations, or rather the reception of those organisations, is they're not yet properly trusted by people in power in either Britain or in France. Huh. Opinion polling seen as kind of exotic American import, and do we really trust it? And interestingly, that's far more pronounced, that cynicism is far more pronounced in France, actually, than it is in Britain. So how seriously they were actually taken at the time of Munich, I would suggest not particularly. They're starting to become more important, but really the genuine official interest in opinion polling really starts when war comes a year later.
Right.
That's when particularly the British government thinks, how can we make use of the BIPO? How can we make use of mass observation? But I think what's also particularly striking about this also speaks to Richard's earlier point about the German reports and the chapter in the book on Italy, is that the British, and particularly the French in the late 1930s, I've come across evidence of this in the archives myself when researching these topics, the French in particular looked at Nazi Germany and said, we've got a lot to learn from them in terms of how we can not just monitor public opinion, but also to an extent control it, manipulate it and shape it. So on the one hand, as Julie's saying, this move towards mobilizing public opinion is partly because you want to have the public on side. You want to have them support you, whether you're a democracy or indeed a dictatorship. But on the other hand, there's always that sense of public opinion is malleable. We can shape this. We can manipulate this through sort of careful, prudent sort of monitoring of it, but then also seeking to kind of mold it. So there's various different aspects, I think, of this going on at this stage, which makes it particularly interesting, particularly that comparison across democracies and dictatorships.
Well, it's amazing to me how sophisticated their reactions are. I mean, they're not just saying we're up to the whim of public opinion or to be blown by the winds of public opinion, maybe is a better way to explain it, that there is this idea that it can be crafted and that A, we have to listen to it, but B, it can also be crafted.
Yes, and I think the other thing that we need to keep in mind is how much was informed at this time by the nascent and increasingly voguish kind of field of psychology, mass psychology, and psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
And I think there's a really direct relationship here. And I think one of the things that our book does, and there are a couple of chapters that deal with this quite explicitly, is again, how psychoanalysis and ideas of mass psychology were informing the debate and driving the debate, as well as driving at least attempting to drive certain government initiatives to prepare the population for a war that was coming from the air, for a gas war, a war that was going to be inflicted almost certainly and disproportionately on civilian populations. So that is something that, again, we tried to draw out a lot. The psychological, but also the emotional impact of the crisis and the way that, as I say, was informing institutional attempts to prepare the population for this war.
There are a dozen scholars who have contributed to this book in the all the chapters are interesting, but what I'd really like to do in the show, and I think what our listeners would like to hear, especially since two of you are veterans, is your own chapters. So Professor Toy, if you could tell us, you've come across new research and done some new analysis and new interpretations about Churchill in Munich. Churchill is, after all, your primary focus of specialization. And like almost everything that you've told us about Churchill over the years, the cardboard cutout is completely wrong, and we need to sort of deepen and contextualize it.
Yeah, so I mean, I might kind of start off with a quote from Vladimir Putin, of all people, if I may.
Right. Which is, yeah, no, that'd be great. Yeah, he'll be pleased. Yeah.
So in 2020, Vladimir Putin published a long article in the American magazine, The National Interest, and here he says, "Today, European politicians and Polish leaders in particular wish to sweep the Munich betrayal under the carpet. The Munich betrayal showed to the Soviet Union that the Western countries would deal with security issues without taking its interests into account." Now, what's going on here in this quotation? Well, partly some Russians today want to justify or explain away the Nazi-Soviet pact of 1939.
Yeah.
And they really want to say, well, you know, yes, we did this deal with Hitler, but it was kind of inevitable because the Munich Agreement of the previous year had shown that the British and the French were themselves willing to do a deal with Hitler at the expense of Soviet interests, the expense of Russian interests, and therefore really, you know, sort of Nazi-Soviet pact wasn't that bad. Now, of course, thinking about, is what Vladimir Putin is saying is true, well, of course, it certainly was the case that Neville Chamberlain didn't want to do a deal with the Soviet Union. But this wasn't true of all politicians, and it was Churchill, who, of course, was in opposition, on the back benches at this time, but really sort of leading the opposition to appeasement. He did want to work with the Soviet Union, and repeatedly he didn't make many interventions during the Munich crisis. He just didn't have the power to do so, but he did make public statements. Right. And what he repeatedly said was that Britain and France should work together to essentially deliver an ultimatum to the Germans. And he believed that by doing this, it would be possible that essentially, not that Hitler would give in, but rather he hoped that that Hitler's generals would see that the game was up and therefore sort of move to overthrow Hitler. So crucial to say, Churchill wasn't calling for war as much as everybody else at this stage. He wanted to avoid war, but he thought that he had a mechanism which would allow war to be avoided and for Czechoslovakia to be saved at the same time. So that's kind of what his position was during the Munich crisis. But really where my research is coming from is to say, well, how did Churchill, who was known to be such a strong opponent of communism, who had demanded British intervention in the Russian Civil War immediately in the years after 1917, how had he switched from that position of the Soviet Union and the Bolshevism being this huge danger to the British Empire? How had he made that move to saying, well, actually, Stalin, you know, kind of guy we could work with?
Yes, I think when most people think of Churchill and Munich, they think of Churchill just opposing Chamberlain, and they don't think about his broader thinking. So how successful was this, you know, push by Churchill to convince conservatives anyway that there is this avenue via the Soviet Union?
Well, I think there were a small number of sympathizers with Churchill who, you know, sort of thought this was a reasonable idea. But fundamentally, you know, this wasn't a brand new idea of Churchill's, that for several months he'd been advocating what he called a grand alliance between France and the Soviet Union and Britain. And, you know, Chamberlain, in a letter to one of his sisters around March 1938, says, well, yeah, that would be a great idea if it would work, and essentially really kind of, you know, pour scorn on the idea that it would be possible. And so really the question is, why did they reach these differing conclusions? You know, it wasn't just a matter of sort of personal idiosyncrasy. And I think that the clue or the solution to why Churchill had made this particular move was actually that his views about the Soviet Union and communism were more complex than is generally given credit for. So he wasn't just somebody who, you know, banged the table and said, you know, I don't like the Bolsheviks. Rather, he had a very sort of specific and visceral dislike of Trotskyism, which he saw as being kind of the antithesis of civilization, as being a sort of a form of barbarism. So that he saw under Trotsky's influence that Russia had descended back into, you know, what he called a kind of, you know, dung heap. At the same time, he always maintained the belief that Russia could in the future be restored as a great power. And although it's quite, it's sort of unclear exactly at what point his change of heart came, because as late as sort of August 1931, in an article which Churchill had published in an American newspaper, but was sort of unknown to scholars, he was warning about the Soviet Union, saying they're going to rearm, they're a danger, in very much the same way that a couple of years later he started warning about Nazi Germany. But after that, there's this kind of silence for 3 years. And then in the summer of 1934, he starts talking about the Soviet Union as a kind of potential, you know, negotiating partner, potential stable factor in international affairs. And the Daily Express publishes an article which has got the headline, and Mr. Churchill changes his mind, says the bogeymen of Moscow are now quite nice. Now, you know, one of the things that had changed, well, not specifically in 1931, but one of the things that had changed since the late 1920s was, of course, that Trotsky had been expelled from the Soviet Union, and that Stalin had sort of moved away from the policy of world revolution. And therefore, we can see that in Churchill's mind, he started to see Stalin and the Soviet leadership as a country which was now behaving much more like a traditional great power, that it was going to operate in its, going to follow its own national interests, of course, but that where those interests coincided with the interests of the British Empire, that it would be possible for the two to work together. So paradoxically, the sort of, you know, the famous Russian purges, which you might expect Churchill to be denouncing strongly as the sort of, you know, exactly the kind of reason why you wouldn't like communism. You might think that sort of this kind of mass slaughter and paranoia would be the kind of thing that you would really turn you off communism. Now, Churchill isn't exactly in favour of the purges. He realises there's something quite strange going on, that these show trials aren't really genuine trials. But what I think he thinks is that actually there may be something to what Stalin is saying, that is to say that Trotskyists may actually be sort of conspiring against the Stalinist regime, and that therefore these old Bolsheviks are getting something like rough justice. Now, Churchill is a bit worried, because he's also worried about the effect that the purges might have on the Red Army. But his view is actually that the Soviet Union is moving away from communism, is becoming more like a normal country. So the sort of classic explanation of, you know, why Churchill was prepared to work with the Soviet Union is that he was just very pragmatic. Mm-hmm. But of course, there were other people who were pragmatic too, who reached, you know, completely different conclusions, and that everybody makes what they think are pragmatic decisions on the basis of their own, you know, values and assumptions. So the fact that Churchill wouldn't have been able to advocate working with Stalin unless his view of the Soviet regime had changed quite dramatically over the previous few years.
And is there evidence, again, as you say, Churchill's a backbencher, but is there evidence, or is there a way we can understand whether Churchill's thoughts about this, or Churchill's maybe applying pressure on Chamberlain, works at all? Does Chamberlain go to Munich with a whole new set of thoughts about the Soviet Union because of what Churchill's saying?
No, I think not. I mean, of course, there are these negotiations with the Soviet Union, between Britain and the Soviet Union, the following year, which break down, and people kind of, you know, suggested at the time and have suggested since that these were kind of very half-hearted negotiations on the part of the British. Other people dispute that and say, no, you know, the British really didn't want that to work. But I think it would probably be fair to say that Chamberlain's heart wasn't in it. He didn't have the same set of convictions. Right. And that really the last person who was going to persuade him of anything really was actually going to be Churchill.
Yes, I can imagine. Well, Professor Gottlieb, one of the most interesting aspects of the book is what you call and what other authors and other contributors call the emotional turn and the ways in which psychology is used both in public opinion and in other ways to understand Munich. And your chapter on responses among the British public is absolutely fascinating. You talk about, you know, the ways in which the crisis was internalized and lived through. This was an entirely eye-opening thing for me. I think most people assume that, you know, people that the British public opinion just got the newspapers and that's all the information they got, and they just dealt with it, you know, almost by rote or by reflex. But there's a lot more to it than that.
Thank you for asking about that. And I think it is one of the more, you know, innovative ways of thinking about this. And it's taking this perspective of how politics is internalized, it's kind of reflecting back. So, you know, we're used to certainly British historians talking about the People's War as the Second World War and thinking about, again, how, you know, that was dealt with in personal life, in family life, and in a psychological sense. But very little has been done to think about how that period of war fear was internalized. And one of the things that I think is really important here in the Munich crisis, and it has, you know, it's not just true of the British case, is that this period, this moment, this crisis, this bookended crisis was really a war of nerves. Okay, it wasn't, you know, war did not break out, as we know, it would be another 11 months before it did. But what there was a type of psychological warfare that was underway, what was described at the time and that needs to be described and better understood as a war of nerves. And it played on people's nerves at every level of society. And, you know, there are dramatic examples of how that war of nerves manifested itself. I don't talk about this so much in my chapter, but I am working on a project that looks at the relationship and the causative nature of suicide and the international crisis, for instance, and that, you know, again, is a tragic and dramatic extreme example of how that war of nerves plays itself out. But, you know, without going as far as that, you know, people reported case after case, instance after instance of the emotional nature of how their anxiety, their fear, the depth of their fear. And then this was also studied more systematically by psychiatrists and by psychoanalysts who sought to use the tools of their profession to understand, again, what was going on, you know, at a collective level. So in using the explanatory tools, the concepts, the therapeutic methods of individual psychoanalysis and projecting that onto the nation and onto nations. Mm-hmm. This was, you know, a new kind of a fresh perspective of, you know, drawn very much from Freudian analysis and Freud's thinking and, you know, applied very directly and immediately to the Munich crisis. But what is clear is also the emotional aspect is how Britain kind of situates itself in the language of emotion. Because of course, we think very readily of the notion of the British stiff upper lip, that Britons don't express emotion, that they are very controlled, self-controlled, that they exercise emotional economy. And why we know the crisis was, you know, mm-hmm. so acute, why it was such a definite kind of moment that stands on its own is because that stereotypical British reserve was broken in these days and in the weeks after the crisis, in that, you know, many journalists, many commentators, politicians, and people themselves, you know, spoke very openly and thought very carefully about how what they had just experienced themselves or what they'd seen in others, you know, broke that trend, broke that concept that that Britons were able to kind of repress their emotions. There was an outburst of emotion, some of it which was seen as quite positive and life-affirming insofar as Britain's rush to the churches after a period of you know, decline, a declining religious observance, and in a, you know, a period that, you know, where we're witnessing general trend of secularization, but then the church and churches become really important again in the days around the Munich crisis as people find an outlet for their anxiety. They seek kind of community and a sense of peace. And actually, you know, a lot of religious figures and religious leaders celebrate the way that the services they can provide suddenly have a new meaning, a salience, and value. And in, of course, there's a much more negative side to that, in that, you know, there was fear that this private and this mass emotion was a sign of national weakness, and the fact that, you know, this was a nation too nervous to go to war, incapable of dealing with the real kind of you know, pressure that was going to be placed on the population to respond in more heroic ways to the call being placed upon them.
Our listeners, our buzzkillers, are going to want to know, how on earth methodologically do you go about finding all this out? There's some of this expressed through mass observation studies because of the journal writing that was involved, but this must have involved a tremendous amount of work in archives and personal letters and diaries and personal communication like that. It seems almost an almost endless well of material. How did you get through it in any sort of, you know, reasonable way without contributing the rest of your life and a couple of other lifetimes to it?
It's thinking a more elastically about the archive as well, and where we can go and find this. I mean, a lot of the sources that I was drawing on were actually printed and published sources.
Oh.
And again, it is interesting to what extent, you know, there's an absolute outburst of publication about foreign affairs around matters of international affairs. And, you know, it's a very, and that's, again, why we need to think about the crisis as the people's crisis. You know, the expansion of the popular press, and, you know, we think about various publishing enterprises which are bringing this to the people. I mean, another important thing to say is that study that we mentioned, of mass observation study of the crisis, is published as a Penguin special in January 1939. So not only is it reflecting what happened, but it brings it to the people, yeah, and to readers within months of what has happened. It's a hugely, you know, speedy turnover. And that in itself, I think, is, you know, so there is, it's observing, but then it's feeding the public interest in its own self and in its own response. And I'll pass over to Richard, who I think will add more here.
Well, I was just going to jump in with a personal anecdote, really, but there's a serious point behind it, which is that this is a time where people actually do start recording stuff because they kind of have this sense of living in historic times. So they start writing diaries, as many people did during the big start of the COVID crisis, for example, because they kind of realize that this is important. I mean, there's a kind of an end of days feel about things as well. But the personal anecdote is that one of these people who started keeping a diary just for the period of the crisis, as far as I know, was my grandmother, who was American, and she was living in London with my grandfather. They were married, didn't have any children yet. And she wrote this diary, which she then sent back to the paper in her hometown, which is the Middletown Press in Connecticut. And so she, you know, it was a strange story, really, because they had been to Nazi Germany on their honeymoon in 1936.
Huh.
And they had brought back various little souvenirs without, I should say, they weren't Nazi sympathizers in the least. However, they were rather apolitical and brought back a kind of a copy of Mein Kampf and various little swastikas, which they had sitting on their fireplace. And one day, my grandfather came back, according to my grandmother's diary, saw all these things sitting on the mantelpiece and said, "Haven't you taken those things away yet, woman? They'll think we're a nest of spies." But the serious point is that sort of later in the crisis, they get this sort of sense of relief that my grandmother is sitting with a neighbor when the news of the resolution of the conference comes through. And, you know, they say, you know, "Good old Nevi, thank God that we have such a wonderful prime minister." And yet a few months later, in another article which she sends back, disillusion has set in when, after Hitler invades the rest of Czechoslovakia in March 1939, they're refugees. She was a social worker. She had some responsibility for meeting the people who were refugees from Czechoslovakia. And you know, you can see that she's going on something of a political journey from, you know, celebrating the wonderful achievements of Mr. Chamberlain to thinking, well, hang on a minute, is there a problem?
That's absolutely fascinating. And Professor Gottlieb, you must have run across a number of these types of sources.
Richard's been holding out on me.
I'm wondering,
do you have a copy of that diary then, Richard?
Somewhere in the... we've definitely got a copy. My parents have got a copy of it, so worst case scenario. Yes, I'll talk to you about that. Yes, we should have used it in the book, no doubt. Anyway, but there we are.
Controversy here at the Buzzkill Institute.
Yes. Speaking of collaboration, yes, there is always more collaboration to be done. But yeah, we do have, it is fascinating to hear about Richard's grandmother's diary, and there were many others like it. And some of them we find, you know, from more systematic collections and again, you know, source production combines like mass observation, and others are much more random. But they, you know, the newspapers were also a good source here in trying to uncover, you know, public opinion and public response and public feeling. Of course, that is, you know, we know how that will be edited, it will be very selective, mm-hmm. and that newspapers will have a narrative that they want to put forward. And indeed, they did. The narrative in the British case, certainly, and I'm sure it's the same in many of the other national examples, is that they wanted to, you know, to convey a sense of calm. I was talking about this kind of emotional inflammation that is caused by the crisis, but the newspapers are trying to go the other way, are trying to be part of the solution to that, and trying to, you're constantly conveying images of the crowd as, you know, under the circumstances, incredibly, you know, orderly and calm and, you know, in control. What they fear most, both, you know, the press, but of course the government, is that, you know, the crowd will lose control, that they'll lose their, you know, emotional reserve and lose their nerve.
Well, Professor Hucker, this is eye-opening for everyone because, of course, there's this talk about the populace and the people is new, I think, for most people's understanding of Munich. But your chapter is on the human and emotional aspects of the high politics of Chamberlain and Daladier. And almost nobody thinks about that I can think of, any, because it's always Hitler and Chamberlain, and it's always high politics and always diplomacy. But the emotional aspect in your chapter is absolutely fascinating.
I've worked on the intersection of public opinion and high politics when it comes to appeasement in the late 1930s for well over a decade now. And approaching this project, I thought, well, what can I do that's slightly different and slightly new and offers a slightly new perspective on this from that perspective of that intersection of high politics and the people? And the way I chose to do this was to weave in a recent kind of trend in international diplomatic history, which is very much my background. I still really see myself as being an international diplomatic right. historian more than anything else. And that is to actually emotionalize these big pivotal decisions. And I think, strange as it may seem, far too often we're all of us perhaps culpable of doing this, we just assume that these big decisions are taken by people of high office in some kind of an emotional vacuum.
Yes.
That they're kind of somehow impervious to the emotional vicissitudes that are afflicting the general population, that they somehow can rise above that. And what's absolutely pivotal to me, or crucial for us to remember, is that they're human beings. Mm-hmm. Neville Chamberlain is a human being, was a human being. Edouard Daladier was a human being. And a good way of illustrating this is to actually draw attention to that well-known image of the Munich conference, which we actually use on the cover of this book, albeit an artistic rendering of it. The image of the four main protagonists, Neville Chamberlain, Edouard Daladier, Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini. And for the most part, Mussolini, Hitler, and Chamberlain are doing that kind of typical 1930s, just staring vacantly at the camera look. But Daladier just looks really annoyed. Uh-huh. Daladier just looks really glum. He looks really upset. He's almost betraying his emotion by his sort of comportment in that particular photograph. And that just really reminds me of the fact that these are human beings. They have a considerable amount of emotional baggage that they're taking in with them to these pivotal, really decisive international conferences. And it's not an easy decision to make. To take your country into war is by no means an easy decision that anyone is going to take lightly. So I really wanted to bring that very much into sharper focus in this chapter by just really reminding the readers that these were two individuals with different degrees of emotional baggage that weighed upon them, impacted upon them in slightly different ways. So for Neville Chamberlain, he in many ways was quite a sort of arrogant, aloof man who really did see himself as being almost some kind of an apostle of peace. Right. That it was his God-given role to save the British people from the ravages of conflict. And so Munich offered him this ideal opportunity to go along and do exactly that. As we know, as Julie's just been speaking about, this was particularly that final week in September when the crisis really crystallized. There was no getting away from the fact that the stakes were simply peace or war.
Right, right.
So for Chamberlain, being able to go across to Munich and then fly back, waving the Anglo-German agreement above his head, the famous piece of paper, and you know, say that I've secured peace for our time, mm-hmm. this gave him the ultimate vindication of what he was doing. And afterwards, expressions of public opinion, he could easily configure those as confirmation that the British public, and indeed the global public, universally supported him in what he had done, and that they were thankful. So Downing Street, it received a deluge of correspondence, telegrams and letters in the immediate aftermath of the Munich conference, the vast majority of which congratulated Chamberlain for his accomplishments. And these came mostly from the British people, but also from all over the world. There's a famous Chamberlain quip, another one in one of his letters to his sisters, where he boasts that he hears that he's more popular in Nazi Germany than the Führer himself.
Wow.
Now, as a result of actually securing peace at Munich. So for Chamberlain, he could see what he achieved as being confirmation that appeasement was the right strategy to pursue, and that ergo he should continue to pursue appeasement, despite those rebellious voices coming from his backbenches, whether it's Winston Churchill or Anthony Eden at this stage or whoever else. He could simply ignore those. He's got a large parliamentary majority. He doesn't need to concern himself with those voices of dissent. For Daladier, it was very, very different. Daladier, of course, the emotional baggage was considerably more heavy in as much as France, unlike Britain, France had an obligation to Czechoslovakia. France had an alliance with Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. So France was genuinely deserting an ally, whereas for the British, they could get away, as Chamberlain did, in saying that Czechoslovakia is a faraway country of which we know nothing. So Daladier knew what he'd accomplished at Munich. Saving the peace was, on the one hand, hugely popular. Nobody in France wanted a war, or very few people in France wanted a war. So he had saved the French people from the ravages, the horror of aerial bombardment and gas warfare. But at what cost? So he was always acutely conscious that this was a shameful capitulation. And there was that paradoxical situation where he knows that he was popular and his immediate return to Paris. So he was welcomed by, you know, huge crowds, hundreds, thousands of people in the streets of Paris, waving, cheering, thrusting flowers at his car as he drove past. But he knew that this was perhaps a shameful episode for France. And interestingly, and this is something that I do, I think, make a sort of central argument in my chapter, I make the argument that Chamberlain was less attuned to popular opinion here than perhaps Daladier was, in as much as the relief was ephemeral. The relief, the sheer gratitude and thankfulness for saving the peace. Very soon, even in Britain, people started questioning, within days, sometimes within hours, thinking, okay, thank God we saved ourselves from the peril of war. But what have we done? At what cost? Thinking about the Czechoslovakians, thinking about the shame, thinking about the lack of honour involved in all this. And very quickly afterwards, through autumn 1938, we do start to see a shift in popular opinion, expressed not just in newspapers, but in letters, in correspondence, in both Britain and France, where the public kind of turns against appeasement and starts to think, actually, that should be the final act. We can go no further along this particular path. And henceforth, we must potentially choose a policy of firmness rather than resistance. And Daladier arguably was more attuned to that public mood, the fragility really of the public mood in September 1938, than perhaps Chamberlain was.
Professor Toy, you raised your hand via the Zoom, the Zoomness of this discussion.
Well, I just wanted to pick up on what Dan was saying, really. And I also wanted to address the absolutely key question which you raised at the start, which is, you know, why did Hitler get away with this? Why wasn't he stopped? Now, I think that what's really crucial is that there's a misconception about Chamberlain. Now, I believe that Chamberlain was profoundly misguided at the time of Munich, but I also think that the caricature of him is wrong. So if you try and look for somebody who symbolizes weakness, people often will just simply go straight for Neville Chamberlain. He's thought to be the epitome of weakness. But actually, he was a strong politician who ruthlessly kept his backbenchers in order, ruthlessly wanted to control public opinion, and had complete belief, complete conviction that he was right and that he could solve these problems. And in some ways, what he was doing was very imaginative by sort of flying backwards and forwards. This was something which no British Prime Minister ever done, this really sort of almost the invention of shuttle diplomacy.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Known. And so where I think Chamberlain was completely misguided was in his belief that Hitler was a kind of a rational actor. Yes, he wasn't a nice man. Chamberlain didn't like Hitler, but he thought that Hitler had limited ambitions, which could in fact be addressed in a rational way. And of course he bent over backwards in order to deliver what Hitler was saying he wanted. Now, the irony is that Hitler did want all those things, but he didn't want them to be granted to him at an international conference with the endorsement of the international community. He wanted to take them, as of right, militarily, by marching in. The fact that he had to sign an agreement to anything, even if he was going to override it in a few months' time, was deeply frustrating to him. So, in a short-term sense, Munich was actually a defeat for Hitler. And so Chamberlain's mistake was not that he was a kind of a weak person, but simply that he completely misread the mentality of his opponent.
Yep. Professor Hooker. Yes.
Yeah, just following on from Richard's comment there about how Chamberlain is often misrepresented, I don't think he was necessarily misrepresented at the time. This is a subsequent kind of historical construct. Mm-hmm. So the following year, if you look at mass observation in September 1939, when war does come, many people are saying, oh, poor Neville Chamberlain, he tried his very best. And he was hoodwinked maybe by Hitler, but so were we all. There was a lot of sympathy, I think, for Neville Chamberlain. The narrative that Chamberlain was weak, that he was simply taken in, that he was gullible and naive, I think is very much a post-1940 construct.
Professor Gottlieb.
Yes, thank you, Dan and Richard, for raising those points. And it's important. And just to add a little bit to that, when it comes to portrayals of Chamberlain and sympathy and kind of affection for Chamberlain, let's not forget, and tying into an earlier podcast, let's not forget the disproportionate number of women who felt very positively and very affectionately for Chamberlain. And you know, his reputation is one that is made much later, because his immediate reputation is one, there is great sympathy and gratitude, an incredible amount of gratitude expressed for Chamberlain, and not only in Britain. And this is why it's important to bring in comparative and other national examples. That gratitude is felt and expressed very deeply across Europe. And if, again, an interesting looking at sources, going to the Chamberlain archives, the Chamberlain's papers are held at the University of Birmingham. And there's books and folios and postcards and letters of people in, of communities and towns and associations in France, in Germany, and elsewhere, and in Belgium, who are sending these tokens of their gratitude, books filled with signatures, all, praising and offering, their deepest heartfelt and religiously constructed gratitude to Chamberlain for having saved the world from peace, for being a man of peace, for being the savior of peace. And that's exactly the language that was used.
Professors, throughout reading this book and throughout listening to you, I keep being reminded of what's been happening. And sorry for the Amerocentric notion of the nature of this question, but for the last couple of years, with something called the 1619 Project and then this 1776 thing that came out last year, American historians in America have been assaulted by this idea, that this backlash, that, certain things in history are answered. We know what happened. We know what the problems is. We know who was right and who was wrong. And certainly Munich was one of those. You know, we know absolutely that this was a cave-in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yet your book, and like so many others, and by the way, we haven't mentioned the other contributors, but people can go to the Buzzkill bookshelf and get the book, shows how dynamic and fresh and constantly improving the study of history is. Do you get similar sorts of reactions when you tell people I'm working on a book on Munich and they say, well, what? We know all about Munich. That's been solved. That's been answered.
I'm not sure people quite say that. I mean, I think it is very interesting that there is this, I think we still have a national-centric view of the Munich crisis very often.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, it's quite interesting that actually Munich is not seen directly as part of a heroic narrative. Very often people try to tell their country's own history in such a way as to make that country look good. This is in the UK, this is a story where pretty much everyone across the political spectrum more or less agrees that this was a bad idea. And occasionally you get historians who pop up and say controversially, maybe it wasn't such a bad idea in the light of the circumstances at the time. Maybe this bought more time for rearmament, et cetera, et cetera. But there's this sort of key assumption that, yes, this was a terrible thing, although in the heroic British national narrative, all these sins were sort of washed away when in 1940, when Churchill takes over. But of course you can look at it, if you sort of take the the Vladimir Putin point of view, then actually it wasn't from the point of view of Britain. Yes, it may have been kind of undesirable from the point of view of the world as a whole, but this was a kind of a masterstroke of diplomacy, where the British and the French were looking out for their own interests. So I think one should, and I think this is the great advantage of the book, really, is that trying to look at the Munich crisis from multiple different countries' perspectives, hopefully kind of takes those blinkers off and allows you, even if you don't agree with these other points of view, to see what those points of view actually are and were.
So, Professor Gottlieb.
Just to add to Professor Toy's point there, I think one of the things that we really set out to do in this book and hopefully have succeeded is making sure that we haven't left the checks out of the story the way that they were left out very blatantly and callously from the actual Munich conference that sealed their fate. And we have two very fascinating chapters in the book on Czechoslovakia that tell the story from different and both from very interesting and provocative perspectives. But we also were trying to provide as much of a comparative and an international and a transnational perspective as possible. So there's chapters two on Germany, on France, on Hungary, and of course on the United States as well, as there are quite a few on Britain, but trying to take different methodological perspectives.
Well, Professor Hucker, you're the latest member to be given a research fellowship here at the Buzzkill Institute. So we'll leave it with you to wrap up the fullness of the book, what I think of. There's another word that kept coming to me as I was reading it.
Yes. So the book itself, I think, does two particularly new things. The first of those we focused on quite heavily already today, which is the emotionalization of this crisis, the emotional angle of it. The second real kind of new thing that it does that we focused on just over the last few minutes is it internationalizes Munich again. So bringing in all these various different national perspectives, but not just doing it as a form of tokenism, but doing it in a way that actually challenges some of the dominant perspectives that maybe scholars and students of this period already have. So, for example, the chapter on France really problematizing the notion that France was either torn between the pro-Munich group and the anti-Munich group. Hmm. In actual fact, suggesting there's scope for people to be both pro and anti-Munich almost simultaneously. Chapter looking at Czechoslovakia, problematizing the narrative of Czechoslovakia as the defenseless victim in all of this. And also looking at the use in post-war Slovak communist propaganda of the Munich crisis and the Munich conference to kind of underscore and legitimize that particular regime. Also the chapters on the dictatorships, whether it's on Russia, but particularly whether it's on Germany and Italy, coming back to some of the earlier issues that we've discussed here about is it possible to shape and mold and manipulate public opinion?
Yeah.
In many ways, some of these chapters suggest that it's far more difficult than it may seem, even in a dictatorship, that despite the best efforts of Goebbels, despite the best efforts of the Italian fascist authorities, they could never quite get their publics 100% behind them in their effort to essentially militarize their countries and gird them for war. And to a large extent, perhaps that does explain why Italy was rather late to the party, joining the war only in 1940. So I think even when we internationalize, even when the contributors to this book internationalize the crisis, we're doing so hopefully in new, novel, and innovative ways that will hopefully be of interest to many different readers.
Well, I think it will be. I think it'll be essential. And that's why Buzzkillers should go to the blog post for this episode at ProfessorBuzzkill.com and get the book, The Munich Crisis, Politics and the People, International, Transnational, and Comparative Perspectives. And so it just remains for me to say thank you, Professor Toy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Gottlieb.
Professor Buzzkill, thank you.
And thank you, Professor Hucker.
Thank you very much.
Let's just say to the Buzzkillers then that we will talk to all of you next week.